Well, I can give you a lot of evidence that that's a lot closer to the truth. WAQRYY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
You keep on passing this antenna thing back to me. I only just put my two cents in, okay? I mean, you know, this is not my question I was going to ask you from, you know, when I first signed in.
You have the floor right now because everyone else wants to be put at the bottom of the list. So why don't you ask your question right now? And I'll try not to be so hot as a scholar, if you know what I mean.
Well, you're the net foreman here, or whatever, so you can do what you do here. Question was, last week or 2 weeks ago, I said something about tuning a preamp, or actually checking a preamp, and you said you had some issues with the way I checked it. All right, you're familiar with the A2R preamps. I use them on UHF for various applications and so forth. And you said you had some issues with how I was checking it. And I didn't get any kind of feedback from you after, you know, I made the comment on, you know, what I checked and so forth on the thing. You want me to elaborate now how I set it up again and see what you got to say?
Okay, I'm going to go by my memory. Let me let the machine fully drop. Okay, we got to get at least two beeps, otherwise we do a timeout of either the part A or the part B of the system, this complicated system. You told me you took a advanced receiver research preamp. It's got a GasFET MGF1302 equivalent in there, and you found out that it's at least 1 or 2 dB low in gain. And by retuning, you managed to get to 17 dB of gain up to 19 or 20. You got more gain out of the preamp. I accept that. The tacit assumption was that more gain means better performance. Not necessarily so. Particularly with GasFET, when you tune a GasFET for highest possible gain, you're forcing the input impedance of that preamp to be 50 ohms, and if you are tuning the output, you're forcing the output impedance to be 50 ohms. That will give you the highest gain when a bunch of other characteristics inside the preamp are being properly met. Good shielding, the right voltage, healthy GasFET, and so on. When you tune a GasFET preamp for the best possible noise figure, it will not be a 50 ohm input impedance. Of course, that sounds crazy. It's a reality. As you detune the input circuit of a GasFET in just the right direction, the gain goes down a little bit. The noise power it generates goes down faster. If you can make the noise power it generates go down faster than the gain you're losing, you come out ahead with higher signal-to-noise ratio. So adjusting a preamp for best noise figure is not peaking the gain. Peaking the gain gets you into the ballpark. You only get to home plate when you detune it to a very specific point. Go to the data sheet on any of these GasFET transistors. The noise figure section will show you a Smith chart with a crazy bunch of rings off to one corner of the Smith chart. And as you get into that corner, which is a mismatch to the impedance input, you'll get lower noise figure. So although you maximize the gain, you may have hurt the noise figure a little bit there, Joe. To B2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, let me explain what I actually did. And maybe you can, let me just tell you the whole setup and I'll tell you what I did, how I checked it. You can tell me if I'm right, wrong, or whatever, or different, or whatever. I took a service monitor, IFR 1500, which is a pretty decent one. And I used a test cable between the duplex port of the unit, which enables you to transmit while it's receiving. And I connected that through a 6 dB pad, a coupler in between, BNC coupler, because the preamp is BNC, and another 6 dB pad on the other side. I wanted to totally make sure that the preamps were 50 ohms or something near like it on both sides. I put the tantiometer at a certain level and looked at the level on the spectrum analyzer. Actually, I looked at that first and I saw I could see the losses of my two attenuators. But that's not what I was actually tuning it for. I turned the generator down to about minus 87 dBm on the dial for me to get 12 dB sine add, feeding it back to its old receiver decoding the signal in AM, about, I think you said, about 30% modulation. So I simulated all the same things like you said, 30% modulation, and I got about a, you know, 10, 12 dB figure at about minus 87 dBm. I put the preamp in there, and I could now see the gain the preamp was giving me. The sign of reading went, you know, quite a bit higher. So now I can go back on the dial and go down further, and I saw my 16 dB of gain. I says, okay, this is a brand new preamp. I'm not going to damage it, you know. I opened the cover, and I tweaked it slightly, and I was able to get the sign of reading to go up further. So my end-to-end gain with this device actually started approaching 18 dB. Now, is there anything wrong with doing that? Because at the end of the day, I want to hear a weaker signal, okay? I've tested these preamps on receivers, putting it into a receiver that has, say, a commercial receiver that, say, has a stock sensitivity of 0.5 for 20 dB of quieting, and a similar receiver that has a spec of 0.2 for 20 dB of quieting, all right? At the end of the day, putting a preamp into the hotter receiver, you don't see the 6 dB difference. It works better. It gives a better effect on the receiver that's a little deafer than the one that's super hot. But in either case, do you find how I test the preamp to be a fault?
I think I'm now agreeing with you more. There's a bunch of ambiguity still. Most people use a SINAD test on an FM system. You made it sound like you adjusted for 30% amplitude modulation. Most people, the SINAD function is usually used on an FM system. Were you doing it with FM or AM? First, give me a repeat on that one, Joe.
Well, I actually did it on both. I used FM. On FM, I used about 3.3 kilohertz deviation and did the SINAD test there. And I also repeated the same procedure in AM because the service monitor can send and receive both AM and FM modulation.
Okay. And the way the SINAD function works is that it first looks at the amplitude of the 1KC note, uses that as a reference. Then another portion of the circuit nulls out the 1KC and looks at everything left over, and it causes noise and distortion. SINAD stands for signal to noise and distortion ratio. So it looks at the ratio between those two, and it is a kind of signal-to-noise ratio test, a very sophisticated signal-to-noise ratio test. And it works better in the long run than 20 dB of quieting. But that was the older test that people used to use. And the two are somewhat close. In other words, the number of microvolts to give you 12 dB SINAD and 20 dB of quieting on many systems comes fairly close to the same number of microvolts. So from what I'm hearing, you set the system up where the preamp saw pure 50 ohms in and 50 ohms out. And you adjusted the preamp where in that system it gave the best SINAD. I see a problem. I see a definite problem. It's not going to be an easy one to convey either. Let's assume now that I've got a preamp that when everything is running hunky-dory, the preamp is getting 4/10 of a dB of noise signal. And it's got, oh, we'll say 17 dB of gain. And under good conditions, at 432, an AR squared can do that. Let me drop. If I was really putting that into an extremely good radio, the rest of my radio system might have a 1.5 decibel noise figure, and with 17 dB of preamp gain in front of that, I'm pretty much overriding most of the effects of that 1.5 dB of noise figure. And I'm going to get very close to the 4/10 of a dB noise figure of the preamp as the overall system performance. That's good. And that's the right way to adjust a preamp for best possible SINAD. If I now set it up with test equipment where I've got pads after the preamp, so that now the rest of the receiver, from the output connector of the preamp, if the rest of the receiver looks like a 20 decibel noise figure, and now I adjust the preamp for best SINAD, I will be adjusting it for maximum gain. I've got 20 dB of noise figure to overcome. Gain in that case counts more than noise figure. So depending on how you set up the preamp and what the secondary noise figure of your test system is, you'll get two different adjustments of that exact same preamp, even though in both cases you're maximizing the sine ad performance. Does that make some sense, sir, Joe? W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Well, I can't measure the noise figure of the preamp. It's spec'd nominally when it comes to the factory at 0.5 dB with 16 dB of gain. The noise figure, I don't have the instrumentation to check that with. So I'm going to only use what I have available to check it with. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it's telling me that the preamp has gain to it. I am able to hear a weaker signal. True, the sensitivity of the receiver and the service monitor is not very good. Typically, so the thing to hear any kind of reasonable signal at all, AM sensitivity is somewhere around 2.2 microvolts in the front end receiver of these things. They're not that terribly sensitive. So in the case of this, yes, it does show that it makes it a lot more sensitive. I was just basically questioning the whole thing in general with the way I tested it. Did it seem like it was a viable way of testing the preamp to tell if it was working correctly or not?
There's a yes and a no to that one, Joe. If you want the preamp for maximum gain for a system that is gain-starved, by that I mean a receiver system. By the way, you said it takes 2 microvolts to get good desensitization, good demodulation on your service monitor. You go through the mathematics of that, and it's somewhere around a 15 decibel noise figure. If I put a preamp in front of a cold receiver, one that's got 15 or 20 dB of noise figure, and I adjust the preamp for best possible overall receiver sensitivity or sine ad, whichever you like, or 20 dB quieting, I will be setting it for nearly maximum gain on a cold system. If I connect it to a hot system, one that is both 50 ohms input impedance and 1.5 dB of noise figure, and I'm putting a 0.5 dB noise figure preamp in front of it, now when I adjust that preamp for best sine ad, I'm adjusting for best noise figure, which will not be maximum gain. If you take the cascaded noise figure formula, that's that formula where you start off with F1 plus F2 minus 1 over gain 1 plus F3 minus 1 over gain 1, gain 2, and so on, and you plug in all the numbers in hard numbers, not decibels, and when you get an overall system noise figure out of that, noise factor we're going to call it, you take 10 times the log of it to convert it back to dB. You experiment with always keeping the preamp, the F1, half a dB of noise figure, the anti-log of that, you're going to plug in the formula. And now you play with the F2 numbers. Start off with 1.5 dB of noise figure, and then later on make it a 10 dB or a 20 dB noise figure. And then you play with the gain of the preamp. Don't forget now the second term. The second term is F2 minus 1 over gain 1. Because you're dividing by gain 1, if F2 is a big number, how big is the number you're dividing by, the gain 1 in the numerator and the denominator counts a whole lot. If F2 is a small number and the noise figure of the system is dominated by F1, then making the best F1 will count, and the gain 1, which is in the second term in the denominator, doesn't count. You have to play with the numbers. You'll see that a starved system, you'll be maximizing the gain. A hot system, you'll be maximizing the noise figure. Those two adjustments of a preamp are significantly different if you're a moon bouncer. If you and I are doing terrestrial work and we're listening to signals over the horizon, the difference is kind of small. But you're really doing serious satellite work or moon bounce work where you're working with super weak signals. Then noise figure versus gain peaking of a preamp is a significant difference. This is another one of those things you're going to have to
repeater, timeout, cancel.
This is another one of those situations you're going to have to hear it a couple of times before it makes sense, or you have to play with that cascaded noise figure formula. You may have some further comments on this one, so W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, and TechNet.
No, I don't have any too many comments in it because, I was simply trying to make, determine if the preamp was working correctly, if I can make it work any better. As I said, I tried the preamp on a standard commercial receiver of two different types. I'm not using these things for signal sideband or things like that. I'm using them basically for FM. type of communication to work. And I know the receivers have a certain limitation by themselves. They can only go down so far in the noise, and you can't get anything past that. Like I said, with the receiver that's a hotter receiver, a stock but hotter receiver, you don't see the extra 6 dB that the receiver has normally by itself when you put a preamp in front of it. Typically, I've seen that be only a difference of about maybe 2 dB.
Matt Dick, KQKY.
That's just the way it should be, Joe. As the receiver gets hotter and hotter, it appears as though you're getting less and less performance improvement with the preamp. It appears. Although there are times when that 2 dB improvement will definitely make the difference of a QSO or a non-QSO. Let's see if Mel has worked with some of these super low noise preamps. And have you seen some of these crazy effects, Mel? K2KEY, KQRAW in the group.
Exactly. That's what happened. I got into this dilemma almost exactly the way Joe was just putting it. And finally, I went ahead and I built myself a preamp using MRF 586 transistors. Supposedly a noiseless feedback type configuration. However, somebody that's very smart that I know, up there a lot more than me, I guess, he says, well, listen, best thing for you to do is put in separate bias control so that I can adjust each one of the transistors individually so that I can then tweak it. And believe it or not, that would seem to be the answer to getting a better performing preamp. First of all, I wanted to match a 50 ohm bandpass filter, and I also wanted, of course, to match it to the mixer signal port. That's the way I was going, and I found that the best way to do that, I set the gain originally. I set the gain to around 8 dB, and I set the input and output impedance to 50 ohms, and I was able to adjust that to get, I measured about 48 dBm. I think about a 1 dB output compression point, say about 25 dBm. I'm just trying to get this off the top of my head. But you get some, basically what the method was, that was the whole idea, I think, was being able to set the bias for each transistor separately, being that there was, of course, a input transformer and an output transformer in the preamp stick over.
Yeah, one of the great ways that you could maximize the performance of a receiver, if you have the ability to adjust the bias of each of the stages, maybe also the impedance matching of each of the stages, you then could play with the compromise of best sensitivity or best instantaneous dynamic range, two very different settings. When you set the individual stages to higher bias current, so they're capable of tolerating a stronger signal without saturating, you'll have a lot more dynamic range. You can tolerate strong signals at a very slight loss in sensitivity. But when you adjust for the best possible sensitivity, you're adjusting many of those stages to lower current, where they give slightly better noise figure, but they can't tolerate strong signals. You can't have it both ways. A smart guy will have the best preamp he can get a hold of, and he'll set it up with a set of transfer relays around it so that when he's in a strong signal environment, he can bypass the preamp. Doesn't matter if the preamp's on top of the tower or in the shack. In either case, you might want to bypass the preamp in order to tolerate strong signals if you happen to be operating during a VHF contest and a small number of miles away from you, in my case, like 30 miles, guy running a potent, really, a real big VHF contest operation on top of a mountain in Connecticut across the Long Island Sound from me can bomb the daylights out of me because they got direct line of sight to them. And if they aim their antennas down to the southwest through my TPH, I can almost rectify the energy coming off my antenna and run a neon bulb, if you know what I mean. And so my receiver jumps off the table until I bypass the preamp or put a step attenuator at the antenna. There are times when I've listened to weak signals during a contest operation My antenna is aimed down toward Philadelphia, and the back lobes are aimed at the strong stations in Connecticut, and they're bombing the daylights out of me, and I put a step attenuator in the system so that I don't get the intermodulation distortion that was covering up the weak signal I wanted to listen to. So I was literally listening to a weak signal by putting in attenuation. And in that environment, it worked. It maximized the dynamic range of the system. So setting a preamp for best possible noise figure and best possible gain are two separate settings. And when you're adjusting for best possible noise figure, the rest of the secondary noise figure of the system under measurement, let me drop. The rest of the system has to be hot. Question recognized. And if I have a system with very high noise figure in the secondary stage after the preamp, and then I adjust the preamp for best noise figure, I'll end up adjusting for best gain. And the difference is not huge, but it is a significant difference if you're really trying to measure best possible sensitivity of super weak signals like some satellites or noise figure or radio telescope operations or moon bounce operations. Person with a question, start off with your call letters and name, sir. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, get back to me then, Dick.
You're on.
K2MIT procedural question. Where do I stand in the queue? And would I be jerked if I were to request and the net would allow me to ask my question? The reason why I've been home the entire weekend without my family, and they're about 45 minutes away. And once that happens, I lose my balance. If I have to wait till next week, I'm happy to do that. K2MIT.
Understand, Jeff. Were you the person that said questions?
Oh, yes, sorry. I was the person that said questions.
Okay, everybody else wants to be put to the bottom of the list. You didn't. Jeff, you're number one on the runway. Go for it.
Okay, a lot of theory tonight. Today I'd like to ask some practical questions. I am finally, after many years, having a 9-foot tower put onto the top of my house by Mike Crawford, W-A-2-B-U-N. I put on 36-inch space across, directly across the center of the A part of the house, at 43 feet, two double stack 2x10, and you can lag bolt it in, and those things come through with rods, and they're lag bolted into the rafters. So my first question was, given the wind that we have recently, how do you prevent the antenna from the mount torquing the roof? And what is the procedure? Do you set the antenna to float free, sort of like a carrier, an aircraft carrier going into the wind? Because I would assume that if it was against the wind, it would apply more resistance and thus torque the house more, so to say. So I'm very new to HF antennas. The second part of the question, if you don't have time, I understand, is I'd like to get to 160 and 80, and I was thinking of having a DX, Alpha Delta DXA, or a sloper antenna, where top is connected to the tower and the bottom is connected to like a 10-foot pole, and then there's a down lead that acts as a counterpoise. Have you had any experience with those? Do they work well? The more important question is the torquing and how do you make the antenna not be a load, if you will, on the house, K2MIT.
Very fine. When you're on a roof and you're putting in fine little drills and doing whatever procedure to try to find the rafters. You'll find the rafter, but you may not find the center of the rafter. You may easily find a little bit off to one side where the lag bolt you're putting into the rafter is almost ready to break out of the side of the rafter. For a whole bunch of reasons, I do not recommend using lag bolts in the rafters. The only thing that I trust when it comes to making a strong roof mount is what I call the sandwiching approach. You've got something like a 2x8 or a 2x10 on the roof so that the leg of the tower is not digging into the roof. It's digging into the pressure-treated 2x8 or 2x10. On the back side of the roof, on inside the roof, going across multiple rafters is another 2x10, and you're putting a bolt, a machine bolt, a carriage bolt, with nut and washer, lock washer, and maybe two nuts to make sure that they're backing each other up and then jammed together so it doesn't come loose. So I'm making a sandwich where on the outside of the roof you've got a 2x10, under that you've got shingles, tar paper, sheeting, and then rafter, and then after the rafter on the inside you have also at right angles to the rafters another 2x10, and now the carriage bolt, the machine bolt, great big bolt, is sandwiching between the two. So the rafters are being squeezed together by a pair of 2x10s. Lag bolts tend to pull out unless you did a very good job of hitting the center of the rafter. The rafter didn't split. You drilled just the right pilot hole so that the threads of the lag bolt dig into the rafter without applying so much pressure to split it either now or downrange. So the sandwiching technique gives you two or three times the strength of any lag bolting mechanism. That's my strongly felt opinion. Been there, done that, put lots of things on roofs in the past when I was putting up a 12-foot satellite receiving dish on the roof. Let me drop.
Hold on, question.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Yes, I did exactly what you were saying. I described it completely incorrectly. It is a sandwich approach.
Okay, the next step of strength beyond that, if you're putting up a very high wind load antenna, is you could guide the tower to the corners of the roof. The guy wires make a huge improvement in the amount of torque that the 9-foot-long tower is going to apply to the roof. Thirdly, the antenna itself. Yes, the antenna, if the boom is aimed into the wind, most antennas have less wind load than when it's broadside to the wind. But almost all rotary antennas are gravity balanced and they're not wind balanced. In other words, because you've got a longer driven element and you've got other hardware in the back of the antenna, it tends to be heavier. Therefore, the mounting mass, the mass mount tends to be aft of center of the center of the boom in order to gravity balance. That means there's more boom sticking out front. The boom sticking out front acts like a weather vane, and the antenna always wants to aim itself downwind. And that'll twist up your rotator, it'll twist up your tower, it'll grind the gears on your rotator. A very simple expedient is to put a vertical piece of sheet metal of the right size at the reflector area of the boom. You put a small piece of vertical sheet metal held on there with a U-bolt, and when you choose the right size sheet metal, there's a little bit of art and science doing that, you can make your antenna wind neutral. There's two or three advantages of doing that. On a high wind day, the antenna doesn't aim itself downwind. So also on a high windy day, you'll be able to aim it in any direction you want. You'll be amazed how many guys on a high windy day, they can't rotate their antenna. They can take it off the brake, but it won't rotate clockwise into a high wind because the thing is one great big weather vane. You can make the antenna weather neutral, wind neutral if you're smart enough. Lots of people don't do that. They don't even consider it. And they grind up rotators in the process. Well, on a windy day, they can't aim it where they want to aim it. Now, when it comes to the sloper antenna, Mel's the guy on that one. Let me turn it up back to you, Jeff, because I know you're running out of time. K2MIT, K2LIW.
Okay, that sounds great. I was thinking that in a high wind day that you take the brake off and there are no gears, you just sort of let it spin by itself. I'll speak to Mike, WA2VUN, who put up a ton of antennas. About this vertically, if I'm thinking about it properly, vertically oriented piece of sheet metal close to the boom, correct?
It's mounted on the boom close to the reflector. See, you got more boom out in front of your mast than you do behind. If you add more wind load behind the mast, you can make it weather neutral. And you can't take the brake off permanently. Great sounding idea. With almost every rotator I know, you'd be continuously putting current into that brake mechanism, and that is intended for a very intermittent service. You put current into that brake mechanism for more than about 4 minutes, and I think you're going to burn it up. Back to you, Jeff.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought there would be a way to let it spin free, then when the wind dies down, turn it, until it synchronizes itself, and then you're good to go. Maybe that's a better antenna idea. Thank you very much. You've helped me a lot. So vertical piece of antenna closest to the reflector, a piece of metal. Hopefully he'll be able to figure out the size. He's a welder. So I think sounds like I don't have to worry about the torque of the roof. You know, my wife was like, well, is the roof going to come off what was that movie in 1939? The Wicked Witch, whatever. But thank you very much. I appreciate everyone's patience in letting me go before everybody else. K2MIT, back to you, Dick, and I would like to dedicate this session, or my question at least, to Lou, W2BIE.
K2KY, but comment.
Mel recognized you don't need a welder for that piece of metal. It's going to be held on with a simple U-bolt. The antenna, if you let it go free, sounds good on paper. If you really did it, Mother Nature would wind that antenna up. Your coax cable would be wound around the mast a couple of times and ripped off the antenna. You don't want to freewheel an antenna, with rare exception. You want to make it wind neutral. Go ahead, Mel.
I was going to say, when he had a rotor, he geared up pretty quick. That will destroy the rotor, for sure. All right, no, I was going to finish up before I had made a comment, but we sort of jumped over this. The preamp I was talking about, I built this preamp for my homebrew receiver, which is 1 to 40 megahertz. And the whole thing you started to talk about that I was going to comment on was the third order. Output intercept, and there's where I had to pay a lot of attention to it. I was able to achieve 48 dBm with approximately, I remember, somewhere around 1 dB of output compression. And what this summed up to, basically, I had approximately 25 dBm of gain at about 8 dB noise figure, and this gave me the a front end in that receiver so that today we were on 10 meters and a station came on that was extremely weak. And I already switched over to my homebrew receiver and I was able to get him, well, that receiver, of course, is all calibrated to dB, so I was able to get him at about 18 dB above the noise level and nobody else could copy him. I could not copy him on any of the other receivers I have, basically. So it shows you this is what the preamp is capable of, Dick, over.
Yeah, there's an amazing number of radios that on 15 through 10 meters and 6 meters are gain starved, and during a low sunspot cycle phase when you're not getting a whole lot of ionospheric reflection and you're getting weak signals by ground wave, a good low noise preamp can buy you an awful lot of magic. So I think that's part of what you saw. Also, when you're talking about an intercept point of plus 43, that probably is measured two or three stages downrange. The most universally accepted method of measuring receiver intercept point is at the antenna terminal. And for receiver intercept point of plus 43, at the antenna terminal, that would be a tremendous receiver. Wow. I think it's almost a transmitter, if you know what I mean. Usually when you come down 10 dB from the input power, in the input power, from the input intercept point, if it was plus 43 at the intercept, that means plus 33, which would be 2 watts. You're telling me the receiver can tolerate 2 watts at the input terminal without saturating, and I know that's not true. So I know that your intercept point is being rated for that particular stage. Maybe it's an output rating downrange. And that's an unusual... You can talk about the intercept point of individual stages. Valuable thing to do. But when it comes to the overall receiver performance, the number most traceable to the zero, so to speak, would be input terminal apparent third-order intercept point. I said apparent because it's real. Well, no, it is apparent. You don't measure it directly. You measure it by an indirect process of doing a two-tone test. And setting a receiver for max dynamic range and setting a receiver for max receiver sensitivity very different settings. Been down that road, written some articles on it, some of which got published in open literature, some did not. There's some military receivers out there that I've worked on where they needed to maximize the dynamic range. And some of the procedures you have to go through by normal amateur techniques look a little bit strange. To add padding in crazy places, downrange in the receiver, to stop things from saturating with strong signals. Very few hams would do that, but for tough requirements in a tough environment, you might have to do it. We've got at least two guys here that wanted to be at the end of the list. I think we're getting near the end of the list. Let's see if Lou is ready. And first of all, have I skipped over anybody so far other than the two guys wanting to be at the end of the list? Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW-SECNAT. Okay, I think it's time for Lou. N2YJC, if you're ready there, Lou, go right ahead. K2LIW-SECNAT. Okay, maybe Lou's not ready. Howard was the next guy. N2GOT. Howard, are you ready at this time?
Just a comment about what Mel said about the receiver on 10 meters. I have a 706 ICOM made in the last few years, a Mark IIG, and a Kenwood 440 you made about 20 years ago. Negligible difference in the sensitivity of, with 22-year difference. So didn't really notice that much of a difference on 10 meters today, Mel. Over to you, Dick, MTGO6.
Very fine. That's Howard, meaning GOT, and Howard HWW. We're also hearing him, too. Do you have a comment on what's been said so far, Howard HWW? Go right ahead.
Back to the original question on SWR. I think people get confused when they're using meters, and the meters look at a different impedance along it. As you know, as you go along the line, the impedance changes, but not the SWR. So sometimes your directional couplers or your meters can give you an erroneous reading.
Very fine, Howard. Howard, your audio is quite heavy, but fairly clean, but quite heavy. By the means you're coming in through right now, you might want to cut back that particular mic gain to about 5 or 8 dB. A well-balanced standing wave ratio meter really is a directional coupler. That directional coupler is supposed to be accurately measuring in the forward mode, the so-called calibrate mode, nothing but forward traversing power on that cable. In the reverse mode, or the VISWA measuring mode, after you've done the calibrating, it's supposed to measure nothing but reverse power. Without a doubt, as you connect to various portions of the cable that have standing wave ratio, the impedance at that portion goes up and down. And a poorly running standing wave ratio meter that does not have high directivity in the forward mode and the reverse mode will give you some pretty crazy readings. You move the meter downrange on the exact same piece of cable, and you get a different reading. That's a standing wave ratio meter that has not been properly balanced for highest directivity. When you adjust it for highest directivity, it doesn't give a darn about anything except the fact that the cable it's connected to is 50-ohm cable. As long as it's 50-ohm cable, and it's a meter that has been properly calibrated for its highest directivity in a 50-ohm system, you meet that criteria, then no matter where I put it in the along the length of the cable, it will properly read forward power and reverse power, and I'll get the exact same reading every single time. If I move that meter and the readings change, then my meter is not properly calibrated for directivity. Let me show you why that can happen. I'm going to drop. If my meter is not set in the forward mode to measure nothing but forward power, and if it was properly adjusted, the reverse power should be 30 or 40 dB less sensitive to that meter in that forward mode. But if I'm going to pick a meter now that only has 20 dB of directivity, which is tolerable but not very good. 20 dB of directivity means that If I put 100 watts forward and 0 watts in reverse, it'll measure 100 watts forward. I put 100 watts in reverse, it'll measure 1 watt as if it was forward. Even though it's in the forward mode, and I'm only pouring 100 watts reverse into a perfect dummy load, it'll measure 1 watt forward. At first you'd say, gee, that's only 1% error. Well, stand by. That directional section is voltage sensitive. We calibrate it in watts, but it's voltage sensitive. When it's measuring 1% of voltage flowing in the wrong, 1% of the power flowing in the wrong direction, it's measuring 10% of the voltage flowing in the wrong direction. So now if I connect it to various places along the cable, the forward power and the reverse power, phase-wise, are in phase and out of phase as I move that meter along the cable. And if I choose a place where the forward and reverse power are in phase, I get 1 volt forward plus 1 volt of reverse, I'll read 1.1 volts. I will go to another place in the cable where the forward power and reverse power are out of phase with each other, 1 volt forward and tenth of a volt reverse, I'll read 0.9. Now, what's the difference between 0.9 volts in one case and 1.1 volts in the other case? I'm about to do that calculation as we stand on a Hewlett Packard HP50G. 1.1, enter. 0.9, enter. Divide. Log. 20 times the log. Good. I measure 1.7 decibels of error. Let me repeat that. I've got a meter set with high enough directivity that it's only reading 1% of the power in the wrong direction. But 1% of the power represents 10% of voltage. Therefore, in the worst case situation, when there is significant forward and reverse power, because I can move the meter along the line, and in one case those two voltages are co-phase, another case the two voltages are antiphase, and one of those voltages should never have been there if the meter had been set for highest possible directivity. I'll get 1.7 dB of error between forward and reverse power in those various places. I can correct that now into what Vizwar reading. In other words,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
In other words, my meter, the real Vizwar on the cable might be 1.5, but depending on where I put the meter, I'll measure 1.3 in one case and 1.7 in another case, in which case I'll find out the place where the right length of cable gives me a 1.3, and whatever length of cable that is, I'll start telling everybody that's the magic length of cable we should be measuring our standing wave ratio with, because that's the only place where it comes out accurate, or where it comes out low enough. People come up with crazy theories like that. Most of the time, when you move your standing wave ratio meter by adding another random length of cable between it and the rest of the feed line, and if your Vizwar reading changes and you added 50 ohm cable and didn't do something crazy like adding 70 ohm cable, if the meter reads something different, most likely your meter is not calibrated for high directivity, it's lying to you, and you're going to get all kinds of readings. You're going to get a great big error bubble around the real reading, if you know what I mean. There are times you'll read higher than reality, there are times you'll read lower than reality. So if this is the best of all possible worlds, you'd love to have your standing wave ratio meter, the forward mode and the reverse mode, each calibrated for 35 or 40 dB of directivity if you can do it. If not, you're going to get some pretty crazy readings. If you go to the Roadrunners Microwave Group, k5rmg.org or .net or .com, I'm not sure which one it is, but just Google K5RMG or Roadrunners Microwave Group from North Texas. You'll see an article I've written on this exact subject, and you'll even find out that when you're using a meter that has poor directivity, there's ways you can do some mathematics with that and find out what the real reading is. Once you accept the fact that the meter could be lying to you. K2RIW, listen. Anybody got any further comments on this?
K2KY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? Mel, it is. Go right ahead.
Hey, similar experience of wanting handheld antenna analyzers that you see, you know, meter readings and couldn't understand how this could happen in one specific case. This was Jeff on the 400 megahertz band. And I took my AEA, I have an AEA VHF, UHF antenna analyzer that gives a graphic display. And there was the answer. The display showed a bunch of bumps, bunch of little peaks, secondary peaks. And I said, there's where your discrepancy comes in. The meter will not see it. The meter movement, of course, but a regular meter won't show that. In fact, that's one of the problems, that you must not take those meters as gospel. When it comes to a situation where it just about can't make up its mind whether to go minus J or plus J, then at that point, for some reason, the accuracy of those meters seems to be completely shifted off takeover.
You know, I've also seen what you're describing now. If you've got a swept frequency piece of instrumentation that can look at your antenna system, if you had one simple place of standing wave ratio at the antenna, and if it isn't a tri-band or a quadruple band or a five-band antenna, which means it's got resonators all over the place, if it is a simple antenna like a dipole or a ground plane or whatever, one single resonator, if that's the only place of standing wave ratio, then there is one sine wave coming up, a fraction of that sine wave is coming back if there's some VISWA, and when you sweep that, it moves in a fairly controlled manner. In other words, and by that I mean the swept magnitude of standing wave ratio versus frequency will be a fairly simple bathtub-shaped curve, where the bottom of the bathtub is in the middle of the band when your antenna is tuned, and at the two extremes of the band, standing wave ratio usually goes up. And if we call that a U-shaped curve or a bathtub-shaped curve. However, if my system has more than one causative agent of standing wave ratio, in other words, I've got a splice in the middle and I did a really bad job of a splice, and I've got a couple of whiskers that are almost touching between center conductor and shield at the splice in the middle of the cable, and then the cable goes to the antenna, and right at the antenna I got a T connector, and I got a piece of cable going over to a second antenna. I've now got a very complicated system. I've got two antennas in parallel with a T connector. I got some VISWA there. I got antenna number two, I got antenna number one, and I've got a splice in the middle of the cable. I've got three causative agents of standing wave ratio. As that wave comes out of the transmitter and it goes down that cable, it hits the first splice in the cable, the first VISWA bump, and some energy starts reflecting back. Let's assume that 5% of the energy starts reflecting back toward the transmitter, but 95% of it proceeds forward through the bump at the splice and goes on to the first antenna. Now at the first antenna, it sees a T connector where there's a pair of 50-ohm loads. In parallel, it sees 25-ohm. There's a 2-to-1 VISWA, and roughly 10% of the power left over starts reflecting back down from there. Then there's whatever power is left over goes through the T connector, hits the third antenna. And the third antenna is not perfect, and some energy starts heading back down to the transmitter from there. And the transmitter hitting down to the transmitter from there comes back down to the T connector and bounces back and forth. Also, the energy reflected on the first pass from the T connector goes back toward the reflected energy goes back toward the splice and bounces back and forth between the two. You get that kind of a complicated system when you're now looking through multiple impedance perturbations on the cable. Let me drop. And you've got signal bouncing back and forth between various VISWA devices. You now make a swept curve of that, and I call it a butterfly curve. In other words, as you sweep it in frequency, you'll see all kinds of big bumps, little bumps, short frequency steps between them, big frequency steps between them. You'll see a very complicated curve. I have seen that on real systems, which were not designed anywhere near as bad as the one we just described. But when you have more than one source of standing wave ratio at more than one location on a transmission system, in general, a swept VISWA curve will get very complicated, even if your instrumentation is perfect. You add to that instrumentation which doesn't have high directivity, and it's also making phony forward and reverse signals, and you've got real bouncing signals in the real system, or you can get any curve in the world. There's only 50 ways you can do it wrong, and very few ways you can do it right. If you're a person who has got an exacting personality You want to make measurements that are traceable to the Bureau. You want to make measurements that make sense. You want to understand all this jazz. So when you see complicated swept curves, there's usually at least more than one thing not so good. And if you want to dig deep enough, you can find it if you care enough. K2LIW listening. Anybody got any comments on all this?
K2KY again.
Go ahead, Mel.
Exactly. You basically hit the nail on the head. That is why the only SWR bridge, or I should say handheld antenna analyzer, that if you're going to get into really into doing some, off-speed antenna experiments and all, they got a couple of new ones on the market that have the type of display similar to AEA put out. They put original. And the graphic display, in fact, a couple of them now will even display this chart directly on the screen. Mine, you have to actually use the software program into your laptop, of course, if you're out there, or you store it and take it in-house and look at the computer. But if you look, like you say, you look at the what you see there, you say, my God, no wonder every time I move the dial a little bit, I'm getting another reading, another thing. And, and the end thing is a mishmash. You actually have to see it in, as you would say, more or less real-time, Dick, to really appreciate, really what is happening. Go ahead.
Hey, you said some magic words there when you said real-time. My favorite instrument is a time domain reflectometer. Properly analyzed, it will tell you the distance to fault, DTF, I think they call it. When you know how to look at that screen, you can look through the VisWAR bump, that's at the first connector, hopefully it's a small one. You'll look at the medium-sized VisWAR bump at the splice of my particular example. You'll see a reflection from it. In other words, it's a kind of oscilloscope display where the horizontal axis is time, the vertical axis is the magnitude of the reflection at that point along the transmission line. So a good TDR properly set up can allow you to literally look through a number of perturbations on the system and pretty much figure out what's going on. A man named Steinhelfer has also invented a technique that he called de-embedding. In other words, once you go through the first bump in the system and you measure its magnitude, you know how much it is disturbing the readings of things downrange, and you can gate things in time so that you can literally measure what is the standing wave ratio created by that splice, even though it's in the middle of a system that's got a whole bunch of other jazz going on. And the reason it can do that is because the TDR pulse goes down the cable. Let's assume that 15 feet down the cable I've got this splice. And let's assume for simplicity I've got air-filled cable, which has a velocity factor very close to 100%. Very close to the speed of light. Now, 15 feet down the cable, a signal takes 15 nanoseconds, 1 nanosecond per foot, round numbers, 15 nanoseconds to get there. The reflection off of that splice, 15 feet downrange, comes back toward the transmitter, comes back toward the TDR, so to speak, and 30 nanoseconds of deflection on that screen to the right, I will see the bump of the splice. The signal hasn't gotten to the T connector downrange and the second antenna yet. So as long as I look at the right part of the screen, I know what's going on with just that portion of itself. A time domain reflectometer, let me drop. It really is a radar system inside of a cable. It transmits a brief pulse, and it looks at all the echoes from all the aircraft that are out there, so to speak. Well, in this case, the aircraft are bumped in the cable. And by timing delay, By looking at the differences in time, I can look at the bump created by the splice, I can look at the bump created by the T-connector, I can look at the bump created by the second antenna. If I was doing a standing wave ratio measurement, a standing wave ratio measurement is a kind of a steady state measurement. In other words, I'm putting the signal on that cable for many seconds at a time. I'm getting all of those reflections from all of those points simultaneously, all piled on top of each other. They're all voltage vectors, which means they've got an amplitude and a phase angle. They're all being added together in a vector manner. You take the voltage of number one, the first reflection, maybe it's a small signal, and the vector-wise, it's at 12 o'clock. And the second bump at my fixed frequency of measurement is another signal coming back toward me, which is weaker, but it's at 6 o'clock, not 12 o'clock, 180 degrees out of phase. It partially cancels the first one, and I get a phony reading that's lower than reality at that particular frequency. I go to a slightly higher frequency. Now the number of wavelengths of the cable, a fixed length of cable, but it's a greater number of wavelengths because I've gone to a higher frequency. Now that second bump that used to be at 6 o'clock is back at 12 o'clock, and it's in phase. And so now at the higher frequency, I now read a much bigger bump from those first two objects, the splice and the deconnector. That gives you some idea of why the magnitude goes up and down in swept, steady-state signal. Whereas with a time domain reflectometer, I wouldn't have to worry about the contamination of the T-connector downrange because I'm reading the time domain of the signal going out and coming back from the splice, and the signal hasn't gotten at that early portion of the oscilloscope display, 30 nanoseconds to the right of the zero point, the Big Bang, so to speak. The signal hasn't gotten to the T-connector yet, so it hasn't been contaminated yet. I can separate out the good guys from the bad guys. I can find out how bad is the splice versus how bad is the T-connector, and I can do it somewhat independently. You see some of the magic of a TDR. In the hands of a skilled operator, it can give you a lot of information you wouldn't ordinarily get. If, for instance, you've got an expensive commercial installation, and you've got to bring in a rigger, and it costs $3,800 to bring in the guy who climbs the tower and does the repairs for you. I'm quoting you real numbers. Stand by a second. There are a number of real commercial services, say for instance a cell site, where you bring in a qualified, bonded rigger, and you've got to do the work because you're knocking it out of service while you're doing the work, and you've got to do it at 10 o'clock at night or midnight, and you bring that guy in at nighttime, who's got tower climbing experience, he's got the right insurance, he's got the right bonding, and you send him up the tower to do the repair. If you didn't have instrumentation to tell you where the error is, and now he's randomly replacing things, and you hope you hit the right thing. It costs you $3,800 to get that man on site to do that work. You better have a damn good answer ahead of time as to what you want to replace, because he's also going to be replacing non-expensive hardware. He's doing it in the dark, and he might be creating further damage by putting dirt in the connector, cross-threading it, or whatever, because he's also working in the dark, and it's dangerous. You can see there's a huge value in knowing how many feet downrange is the fault. You'd love to know that ahead of time before you bring in the expensive and damaging help that's going to possibly make things worse. Real world situation. K2RIW listening. Anybody have any further comments on all of this jazz?
W2RIY.
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. You're familiar with the SiteMaster series of equipment that is capable of doing, it's like an FTR. FTR, I guess, frequency domain reflectometer, where you can actually set the frequency that you want to look at and do the same kind of test you're looking at. I recently used that type of instrument and worked with an antenna rigger, got different readings with a guy who would take a jumper, the same jumper, and just simply take the jumper and reverse the jumper. You look at a particular connection at, say, like the far end of the cable, you might get a return loss reading in distance to fall, say, like minus 32, for example, at that junction. And the thing is not like a lab piece of equipment. It doesn't let you go down right to the centimeter on the cable itself, really, in reality. They're not quite that sensitive. But the guy can take a jumper, for example, hooked, say, well, you want a 50-ohm load at the end of the jumper itself. He can reverse the jumper and change the reading at the reading 6 foot back behind that. Now, what do you suppose that to do to?
Oh, there's a zillion things that can cause that one, Joe. Let's assume that the jumper has a improperly installed connector at one end, and at the other end, the connector is pretty good. And let's assume that the way the jumper was originally installed on the tower, that the connector that the bad end connected to was a mediocre performance connector there. So now I've got some standing wave ratio from the connector at the top of the cable where the jumper is going to happen, and the connector on the jumper itself has a not-so-good vigor. And I put those two things together, very close to each other. I mate those two connectors. I'll get one particular standing wave ratio reading. Now when I reverse the jumper, I still got the bad connector, but now it's on the far side from the